members and officials, most welcome, and officials from the department. Perhaps let's request you to introduce yourself and your capacity in the opposition in the department.
Thank you very much, Chair. Good morning. My name is Ganga Sengyu, Chief Director responsible for West Africa.
Ganga.
Yes.
Sengyuwe.
Oh.
Director in chief. You will come and listen there in Parliament, then you can change your country so that in some way it must be interesting. Thank you very much. Most welcome. And the other gentleman?
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Ivan Foster. I'm acting director for Horn of Africa and the Indian Ocean Islands.
Ivan?
Yes.
I've been
Fosula.
Fosula?
Yes.
Oh. Fosula. And I think Fosula has his name after one of your great-grandfather.
He must have been a great uncle.
He must have been an important man of his time. Thank you very much and most welcome. And you said you're coming for the first time here. Very interesting to be here in Parliament with members of Parliament.
Been in Parliament but not to do this.
Yeah, oh, okay. Yeah. In this committee, we rely very much on, now that you are here for the first time, we rely very much on the latest information from different parts of the world, which are not yet in the textbooks. You know, if a coup d'etat has happened yesterday in Lesotho, the historians have not written about it. But the department can research and tell us exactly what is happening, Brexit, Mali, that. So the department is a useful and worthy resource for members of parliament, for their comments, for their debates, etc., etc. Yeah, so you're hoping here, important for us. And Lebo, most welcome.
Thank you very much,
Chair. The Deputy Minister. I have been informed about the political principles 2 days ago about the engagement, so I'm fully aware about who is where. But I want us to record the many apologies that have been brought to my attention yesterday.
Thank you, Chair. The first two apologies, Chair, from Honorable Umbrana and Honorable Mayela, they are attending the Magistrate Commission conducting interviews. And then the other apologies...
Magistrate Commission, I'm not going to say this, sorry.
Yes. The Magistrate Commission conducting interviews, Chair. And then the other three are from Honorable Kenya, Honorable Raposi, and Honorable Lesoma. They are attending the conflict resolution program at DECO. And also Honorable Kalyan should not be joining us. She's at the Pan African Parliament. And Honorable Bachman is attending other meetings, Chair. Those are the honorable.
The Soma conflict resolution, capacity building on conflict resolution, yes. Raputi conflict resolution program, Maila and Umlwana conducting interviews on Magistrates Commission.
Yes, sir.
And then Bergman.
Attending other meetings.
And what does that mean?
Eating and expansion. And then Kalyan, she's attending Pan African Parliament.
AP, she's a member there, and then Kenya conflict resolution. Then Dudley.
Oh yes. My apologies. She's also at DECO attending the program.
or the conflict
yes sir.
Conflict resolution capacity building program.
Yes.
And then Honorable Okota.
No apologies.
Who else? I see most of fizzled out after their member was promoted to be a mayor. They've never been consistent in the committee ever since. Okay, no, thank you very much. Honorable Masihela, most welcome. She's standing in for Honorable
Rakut.
We have requested them to co-opt a member for us in the meantime. Now, there is a proposal we want to make to the meeting regarding the agenda. When we were discussing the many apologies that we're going to have, we suggested that we will say to the meeting that the item on the consideration and adoption of the committee minutes, as well as, the consideration and adoption of the minutes, as well as the legacy report, we should defer that to next week. We were supposed to look at that today. The legacy report of the committee for the next committee. We have said then let's look at that next week so that all the members own up on that report and the minutes. But then we'll proceed with the presentation. So with that, I want to invite Mr. Kanga Tsengiwe and then Mr. Ivan Foslo, to make presentations. I don't know who is handling which item, but I see that the first one is on Madagascar. Okay.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. On Madagascar, I'll be brief and just try and stick to the, as you said, the most recent issues. As you know, Madagascar at the end of last year held its presidential election, which fortunately went very well and not too many disturbances on the 4th of November. And then later a runoff election was held on the 19th of December because out of the 36 candidates, nobody achieved an outright victory of 50% plus one in the first round. The incumbent president at the time, Harry Rajaonarimampianina, did extremely poorly. He hardly reached 9% of the vote. And as suspected, former president Ravamolana and Andy Rajaonarimampianina did the best in those elections. Those two then went forth to do a runoff on the 19th of December. On the 27th of December, the National Electoral Commission (CENI) proclaimed the results in favor of Andy Rajaonarimampianina.
Sorry, there's a temporary invasion.
if you have studied history, you know what I mean by that, about invasion. Sometimes it's temporary, sometimes it's permanent.
To continue, so in following the second round, the National Electoral Commission announced that Andy Rajoelina won the second round.
Yeah, we don't normally do that. The second round is exactly the same as the runoff.
It is the runoff. Second round is the runoff. Yeah. Okay. Sorry. So he got 55.6% and Rabu Malana 44.3%. He then made some claims that there were irregularities in the election. The High Court, Constitutional Court, looked at this and they dismissed it, that it was not material to the outcome. He would not have gained enough votes in any manner to change the outcome. And they then, on the 8th of January, proclaimed the election for Rajoelina. As you know, he was also formerly the president of Madagascar, the High Transitional Council, that after his coup d'etat, it was most formed a High Transitional Council, and then with South Africa and SADC relations, they continued to stand down, and then the previous Harry became president. So he came back in. He immediately reached out to South Africa by inviting a president, even before he was finally announced, to come to his inauguration, and also set out a way forward that he would like to deal with South Africa, specifically in certain economic sectors. And Deputy Minister Landers then went and represented the President at the inauguration. President Rajoelina then moved very swiftly to try and reconcile the island. He reinstated Christian Mthethwa, the Prime Minister, who was already Prime Minister under the previous President Harry. He reinstated him as Prime Minister back, and so to continue with the process. And then immediately the next day, on the 21st of January, he put in the new cabinet. Very interestingly, his cabinet are not seasoned politicians. He went for technocrats. The Minister of Health is a doctor. The finance one is a finance person with a master's in finance. So he went for every sector, he went for a technocrat in that field, which is in line with the way that he ran his campaign, that he says he wants the people to go back to work, he wants the island to move forward, and not going to play politics, he's going to put the island to work. So we will have to see how that works, especially since the fact that they're not seasoned politicians. And we know in Madagascar history, the former presidents like Rabo Malana and old Jacques Chirac, they interfere a lot in the country's processes, playing politics. So how his cabinet will maintain their equilibrium and maintain their momentum at the moment without these older men interfering, we will have to see in the future. But at the moment, it looks like Mr. Rabo Malana has accepted his loss and is trying to reach a hand across to Mr. Rajoelina. And therefore, South Africa continues to remain committed to the national reconciliation process, especially to look at preventing this conflict reuniting between the previous presidents. And as you know, last year, President Ramaphosa appointed former Minister Ibrahim and Ruth Meyer as his special envoys, especially to go and talk now and then and just get people to get closer to each other, these various presidents. And so far it's worked. At the moment, whether or not they need to go there anytime soon, we will have to see what the former president do or don't do. And as I said already, as you know, we've known Rajoelina since his previous term in office from 2009 to 2013 when he was of the High Transitional Council.
Just to go quickly a little bit to the sectors that President Rajoelina mentioned to our president that he really would like to focus on, which is also sync quite well with what our DTI has been looking at the island for about a decade, is he specifically focused, he would really like South Africa's assistance in agribusiness and agricultural projects, of course energy as well, and mining and industrialization, as well as of course tourism. These are, needless to say, very high potential sectors in Madagascar. And we already had discussions with DTI to see how can we elaborate on this. The same discussions we've already, our mission has already started with the foreign minister and the trade minister and various others of the new, and they all mentioned these sectors, including the new foreign minister said he would like to come to South Africa in early April, if possible, to exactly talk to South African investors and businessmen so that we can get these things going. Interestingly enough, in spite of all the difficulties that Madagascar has had over the decades, our bilateral trade with the island is over 1.3 billion rand, which sounds small, but if you put it in the context of the region, our trade with Madagascar and the other islands, Mauritius, makes up 45% of our total trade of the Horn of Africa, East Africa, and Indian Ocean Island. So those two little islands actually do quite well. And our imports from the region, Madagascar and Mauritius, makes up almost 90% of all South Africa's imports from Horn of Africa, East Africa, and India, which is quite substantial. But there's, of course, a lot of scope for growth, and hopefully with their stability that he will bring now, our business can really start going in there and do the work. And needless to say, we will capitalize on these opportunities by also cooperating in the security matters, because like us, they face poverty, which brings crime, and the new president has said he really would like good cooperation with South Africa's police just to see how they can deal with this growing problem that they have. Also in the health sector, as you know, we recently they've had a number of outbreaks of plague and now measles, and their proximity to South Africa, it would be good for our health departments to also assist, because we're always scared somebody would get on a plane and come to South Africa, which almost happened last year with the plague. We stopped the South African getting on the plane who had it just before he was about to board the plane. In beginning 2018, we finally signed a memorandum of understanding with Madagascar to sort of formalize our relationships, and it's called a memorandum on regular diplomatic consultation. The inaugural session of that has not been held yet because they went into the election. So hopefully this year we will be able to inaugurate that system, and possibly we would hope to bring them this side to experience this new government, to experience South Africa. And also look at all these sectors that the president has made. There has been also, over quite a period of time, the Development Bank and IDC has also been working quite closely in Madagascar to try and look if they could fund projects, especially in shipbuilding for their coast guard, because as you can imagine, with their massive coastline, there's a lot of illegal fishing going on, and they've asked our assistance over the time to help them with that. And IDC is willing to finance patrol boats on behalf to help patrol that Mozambican channel and the areas around it. That's in short what we could do in the brief time. So for future, we this new dynamic team of this young president, I think in the next year they are going to move fast. And if South Africa with DTI, that's why we're working with them closely. I think we're having a big meeting with them this week, later this week, to look how can we send our business and to there to look at the opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Foslo. I see that you are ambitious to be a director while you are acting and working hard towards that. And with this ability of unpacking Madagascar, you're getting there. Wish you good luck. There are a few things I wanted to comment upon, and would you like to say something before you leave? If you think we are fine.
Okay.
After the meeting. Okay. I was going to ask you about the history of political instability in Madagascar, which has existed and emerged every time after the elections. You know this habit, is it a habit or is it a tendency? I don't know. I'm looking for an appropriate term politically. The tendency of not accepting the elections and going to court, challenging the first round or the second round, just the history of instability as to what could constitute it that Malagasy would have that kind of polity. And the unfortunate thing in history is that if a country has that thing, it doesn't go away easily. If you look at the history of the DRC from 1960, the Prime Minister didn't stay there for either between 3 months and 6 months. And the guy who stood, who was able to stay for a life was actually a military dictator. So, that is it. And then the Sutu. So, but if in the political culture of a country they accept the elections, there's always a new man and the military doesn't interfere, then there is stability. And some countries have got that political culture, others have got this kind of political culture. And so I wanted to know whether you know anything between you and your colleague. But the other one, whether there is a French hand, and I'm not being unfair to France. The former French colonies have a little bit of instability, which is occasioned by, if you like, French interference or French national interest. In other words, if they see that the candidate who's going to take over is not their man. Well, for now, let's say their man, because they use man. It's not their man. Then they cook up all sorts of things because their own economic interest will not be served. Yeah, in the DRC, you have seen a little bit of that in Mali, a little bit of that, and elsewhere. So I was wondering whether there is a French hand in a thing like this, and the minister just found a very clever diplomatic way of saying this to the Minister of Foreign Affairs, that is there a way in which France can look at assisting the African continent in its former colonies about, but he just found a very nice way. I had them whispering among themselves, and then he came back and said, but we still insist that France must assist. You see. that was the first thing. The second one is the strategic importance and advantage of Madagascar to South Africa, whether in the scheme of things, is it in its political sense, in that in the AU and the UN and generally geopolitically, it is siding with us given its own history, but secondly, whether they are part of the Indian Ocean Association, in terms of which we could work with them about looking at the marine resources of different kinds, and whether South African companies either are already in Madagascar or could set up businesses in Madagascar, like fishing and this and that. And you see, one of the weaknesses about the Indian Ocean Association was that it was going to embark on shipbuilding. Now, I would not discuss Madagascar and then divert into that. But it was that it will embark on shipbuilding and bringing in the historically excluded from the ocean or marine those who were excluded from the marine enterprise, you would know that mainly the colored, the Indians and the blacks, to bring them in various ways, as shipbuilders, as traders, that. And now, to work with countries that are linked to the oceans. Because what we have always insisted to the department and the minister was that after we have struck diplomatic relations with countries, what do we eat out of that? Sorry for the way. We've insisted that there must be no friendship just for the sake of it. There must be trade and economic advantage for South Africa without us saying it aloud. Because everybody is in it for something, for themselves. Like they always warn us quietly, sometimes loudly, be careful of the Chinese. Sometimes they say be careful of the Indians. But those guys want to come to Africa for the same reasons that the old colonial powers were in Africa. They must be in it for themselves. It's only natural. And now, has the appointment of cabinet meant that the political settlement of Madagascar is done and dusted, and we can look forward to some peaceful development there until the next elections? Because if the court declared in the manner that it declared, and then Ravalo Manana was not satisfied, is there a likelihood that they could launch a coup in the intervening period, or just unsettle things? And if you look at this in the context of Lesotho, the coalition governments in Lesotho don't run their course. They will just leave this fellow for 6 months or 7 months. Then they will go and steal the partner from him to the opposition. And once these two gang up together, the Prime Minister will fall, then they come in. Then after some time, that's why this thing goes around three people. My two, can't remember, I remember Tom Taban and Pagalita, but there's a third one.
Oh,
what about my two documents? No, can't tell the medicine, there was this one, who was the one side deputy president, Matejwa.
Yeah,
I'm around this three or among this three, something like that. So that's the history of instability in this suit. But also here, Ravalomanana and the other one, Andre Rajoelina and Ravalomanana, these guys are always there in the politics of this country. And I wonder, what are they up to? Is it for money, etc., etc. Regarding his cabinet, now that you have said he has not appointed politicians, you did not then expand what the implication is. Whether you were saying the implication of appointing technocrats will actually work in the interest of the economic fortunes of Madagascar, in that everybody is an expert in what they are, in the ministry that they are going to head. Minister of Health is a doctor, Minister of Trade and Industry, or Minister of Economy, whatever, is an economist, which can be good for the country sometimes. But if the fellows are completely ignorant about the politics of the country, they may be overcome by those who are outside, because those who are outside know how to, in a very organic way, how to connect with the masses and disconnect with the government. So the government is good, but it is hanging up there. It is elitist. It has no sense of how to address masses and etc., etc. Now, it is a good government, educated, but in an organic link, and that can be a weakness. The politicians emerge from the masses, but sometimes most of the time, they may not have the necessary education for the ministries that they are going to head. So striking that balance by the president to keep provinces together, or regions together, or language or cultural groups together, when he appoints, education may not be the only consideration. It is about whether you are able to look at, sometimes it's a religious community. Sometimes you say, you know, I can't exclude the Muslims, I can't exclude the Christians, or I can't exclude a particular language group. In this case, for instance, perhaps there's an area where mainly you've got the French-speaking community. If you don't appoint from that one, then they feel excluded, and then you end up having a particular situation. Yeah, that would be my comments, questions and comments for now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Regarding these political instability challenges from these, if you look at Madagascar, other than Andry Rajoelina, which is reasonably young, the other main players that has been always at each other's hair are now very senior gentlemen. And they are moving out of politics itself. Rajoelina was the only one who really, in this election, had a reasonably good challenge. The rest didn't even make 1%. Chiraka, none of them even got even near percentage in the region to actually launch any challenge. Even when it came to the second round, President Rajoelina actually had a big gap between him and Ravalomanana, because he really went to the streets.
He went everywhere in the island, and as you know, he's a very charismatic person that knows how to use the modern media. I mean, having been a DJ and a television presenter, he really knows how to use the new media to get to the youth of the country. Like South Africa, it's a very youthful society. And he spoke to them, and on the ground, that was always, he says, I'm going to get you back to work, we will find a way to get you back to work. I'm not going to play politics with your lives. And so even when it came to the runoff, when the other, may I call them the old guard, tried to make a coalition to see if they could push Ravamalana over the threshold, that gap remained. That was in the first round, it just got bigger in the second round. So that older politician, that older guard who seems to play, from our own sources in Madagascar, it's really just the elite who play politics, it seems. The Malagasy themselves, it doesn't bother them too. They have other problems to deal with. But this year, as you do know, is the regional and local elections as well, later of this year. So there we will see a lot more of what you say, the regional and the religious coming through in the local elections. So how Rajoelina will do with his party and organize in the local elections is debatable. But we will have to see that because it's much more on the ground system.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, regarding the former colonialists, the French is always there. They're around, you know, they do their business, unfortunately, between these war, you know, the rosewood, which is banned from being exported from that island, is beautiful. They are literally just putting ships on the beach and pulling it off and taking it away. The rosewood, that famous, beautiful, ancient wood, rosewood, very expensive. They use it in fancy furniture and boats, one of the most expensive woods you can get. And there's an international ban on the export of these trees. And that ban is in Madagascar too. But the Chinese and the French just actually pull boats on the beach and cut them and put them and go. Not throwing fruit. So basically the country loses any revenue out of an export that they don't want to export. Because these trees are a big habitat for their very unique animals. So, if you remember the previous president, I'm just going to say Harry, he's very difficult to pronounce. He, in the beginning of his term, the French thought he was their man.
Yeah.
And as you know, he didn't become their man. He reached out to other areas, to South Africa, also a lot to China and Russia. And needless to say, they turned their back on him, and he only got 8% now in the election. They didn't help him finance his programs, and they started moving into the other old president to try and undermine Harry for a long time. Rajoelina, as you know, he, in the past few years, had a couple of problems with the French, even though after he left Madagascar, he went to France after he had to give up the presidency. He went to stay in France where his wife and children are staying. But when he came back to Madagascar, he then got refused 4 or 5 times visas to go to France to meet his family. And that, as far as we understand, has moved him a little bit away from the French after having refused him a few times visas to see his family.
Mm.
And from what we see, that's probably one of the reasons he's now looking to us. Their own role in Sunday and in the region, I think, they haven't been participating too much in that because of their own internal problems. But as when you come to Iora, they are a member of it. You can't really have this region without that big island in the middle of the sea there. And they will, I mean, that's where they asked us already to engage in that business, especially when it comes to helping them with all this massive illegal fishing problem that they have. The world is fishing their fish out. The Chinese boats, if you take an aerial shot, you see hundreds of Chinese illegal fishing vessels in their waters, and especially between Madagascar and Mauritius. is not Madagascar and Mozambique, which is our breeding grounds of our fish. You see the Chinese trawlers everywhere. So for us, coming back to that point where they formally asked us for assistance to build patrol vessels, which they don't have enough of for the territory. At the last moment when the shipyard was ready to start building it in Cape Town, even the shipyard were going to self-finance up to 60% and the IDC do the rest, the IDC then said, no, we do everything. But just as it was about to vote, the IMF said to Madagascar, wait a minute, this is going to cost too much. You can't finance, you can't do this boat thing. So it stalled. But then whose illegal fishing vessels are in their water? It's the Spanish trawlers and all of those. So suddenly the boats didn't get built. So it is not just a Malagasy problem. It's the whole Mozambican challenge. The other islands all face the same thing. Without patrol boats, they're not going to be able to do that. Now, we have already started talking also with the other islands, because the issue you're talking about shipbuilding and also getting our previous visa into the fishing industries is actually something that we should look holistically around the sea territory of all those islands, Comoros, Seychelles, Mauritius. Seychelles, for example, has a massive sea territory. I mean, they have 110 islands that stretch from near Somalia all the way to the bottom near Madagascar and all the way out to the other side of Mauritius. It's huge sea territory. And they've invited South Africa a number of times to please come and fish the tuna and other fish in their waters, because they don't like some of the other characters who are in their waters. On one condition, could we please just put one factory on one of their islands for processing alternative catch? You know, when you catch tuna, sometimes the unit is other things. And so please process this other catch, this alternative catch for dog food and for other things. And so, but unfortunately, we put it through to our departments, and they, over the years, have never really taken it up. As we move our South African fishing contracts around to give other people, we should not lose the opportunity, maybe saying, if you had fishing contracts, go and fish in those waters. It can be opened in that context, as you said. Seychelles was already invited. Because also one of the principles we looked at for Seychelles, which could be a model for assisting Madagascar, is in South African fishing industry, the concessionaires, if I may say, that fish in the territory, help police it. They report back to us, to our government, to say, this fish, they take the photographs, to say, this thing is busy illegally fishing in our territory, has it got. So we might look at helping these countries in the region, not just Madagascar, adopting that kind of process. When you assign a concessionaire for an area, also get them to help police that area, because it's in their interest and yours, which is what we do in South Africa. Then you also don't need so many patrol boats, because you've got many eyes out there. So I hope that helps. And shipbuilding, the whole region, because I work with the Indian Ocean Islands, all of them say the major impetus for trade is no ships. There are no inter-regional cargo ships traveling between us and up the east coast of Africa. I mean, Kenya's goods have to go to Dubai and stay there for about 3 months before it gets back down to South Africa. How good is that for fresh produce and any produce that can spoil in a container? Seychelles has the same problem. Our goods from here are stuck for 3 months somewhere in a container in Dubai. That regional shipping, that is where IORA and South Africa and all the other governments of the region said, South Africa, if you take the lead, we will come in as a partner with you to build regional shipping. Not just fishing, but also transport, so that goods can get to each other quickly. You know, smaller transport boats with their own cranes to be able to take it off, because a lot of the ports are not really good with fancy cranes. If you have self-craned multi-purpose ships, we can move our goods around, and Seychelles, Mauritius, Madagascar probably will too, if somehow as a collective we can create a regional shipping line which can serve up and down the east coast of Africa and these islands. Some ships going this way, others that. And they will really come in. And that's one thing that IORA could look at. And I think they have started such discussions. But the question is, how do you put in the mechanism of funding, because ships are expensive? You could probably start with looking, repurposing the Galas, who's now retired. Start with repurposing that supply ship, see if she can start doing it. And also use those ships like the Agalas as a, what is it, training vessel for cadets, for our previously advanced, because it's a tough job. The seas can get heavy, you know, to train people, see who's got the attitude for being in the way.
And it's only kind of afraid of water.
But an interesting fact you might not know, Mr. Chair, is that 80% of South African fishermen on the water can't swim. Yeah, that's why I say fall over every time. Mauritius, same thing. They say 80% of their fishermen on their boats cannot swim in any course. So it is a scary situation. But yeah. Even if you can swim, there's ways to get back. So yeah, but Russia is there also. They've been helping the island recently on security issues when South Africa didn't really step in. So we have to watch that space as well. And as you know, China is there. China went down to the center of the country, tried to do mining there. But there, how do they say, human practices dealing with the local population and the mining in the region, the Malagasy seems to have very little tolerance for that. And they have literally chased the Chinese out with pitchforks and stones and things, and literally say, you don't treat us like this. And you don't take these things out without, you promise to help develop, but you're not. You're just extracting and you're treating us really bad.
Yeah.
So actually China asked previous President Harry to protect and help, but they just kept going back, and as soon as the Chinese build something, they burn it down or break it down. And they did not tolerate the way that they are being treated. And
yeah.
So in the two of the main mines there, China has no left. The local population deals with it itself.
Can I just comment this way? With this interesting knowledge and observation that you are making, the question of whether you could find a way to raise this matter with the political principals, so that whenever they have an engagement in the peace and stability sector, or in the peace and stability sector in the government, is made up of home affairs, international relations, defense force, the state security council, and another one, there must be five. And the same thing happens here in parliament. So whenever we have a cluster meeting of peace and stability, we are all there. And matters of national security, which also involve immigration, which involve trade and other things, we actually are able to discuss that. Of course, there is the economic transformation one, or economic cluster, which takes away DTI, etc. We have been able to raise some of these things. In other meetings where I happen to sit, of my organization, as well as in the peace and stability cluster, I think I should be able to raise some of the things that we are talking about. But also, there should be a conferment, and under my chairship, this has not happened well. I think we must tell the next committee, the chairperson must actually obviate this weakness that I had as a chair. We have not conferred enough with the other committees from time to time. met with Public Works, we ended up traveling with them to Namibia on state property. But we should have done quite a lot with economic something of Minister Pater, because we had issues there, and of course also DTI, we had also issues about the trade attachés in strategic towns and cities and countries. So that confinement has not happened the way it should have happened. We are just looking at the oversight work of the department, but there are things that are overlapping. This one is exactly a matter that is overlapping, where the ocean industry is not, or the ocean economy is around our country, is not delivering what it should do. precisely because most of the post-colonial governments have not focused on that. In Mozambique, ourselves here and others, they focused, whether wrong or right, they focused on the political reconstruction, the new constitution, that, away from the French colonizers or English colonizers or post-apartheid, without looking at what then will, you know, increase the economic and trade fortunes of their countries. That weakness has been there. But as you can see, even here in South Africa and also in Zimbabwe, after 20 to 25 years, the political honeymoon actually begins to wane, because everything politically is there. People want to focus on their material well-being now. What are we eating? Where are we working? What is the level of education? What is that and that and that? And when we talk about land, when we talk about employment, we are being forced into that. But this issue about China, China, you also look at the activities in the Chinese Sea there, of Chinese trolleys getting fishing resources next to territories that actually belong to the other countries. What is the old name? Sea piracy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The sea piracy is continuing in many other guises. Now, these people who are supposed to be, for lack of a better word, sea police or sea guards, you don't have enough of people like that who can police the vast territory, say sometimes it stretches 300 kilometers from your country to another. This is part of you. But somebody does something else there, and you are not able to police it, and therefore they steal your fish. And therefore that means they steal your economy, in fact. So that is a matter that I think in my organization I can also raise. But it's not a political matter for one organization, it's a matter of national interest. You can continue and conclude. Yeah, you can continue. Okay.
Just for your information, Chair, is that actually, last week, the South African Shipbuilders Association actually, weirdly enough, contacted me to talk about shipbuilding, ship servicing, training of people in the region. So they are really trying to focus on see how they can, because it can be a massive industry of for our coastal regions of South Africa, as you know, which is quite high levels of employment.
Yeah.
If the shipbuilding, ship servicing,
yeah,
and maintenance of all of that can be lifted up, because it also improves a lot of skills, handwork skills in the region. So I've spoken to them, they've contacted me, because I did a similar thing in New York with the shipbuilders, to see how they can contact with our region, help them build ships, out service the ships, maintain them using our cadets and their own as a joint venture. So it's something we will explore soon, because it's not something our state-owned enterprises can do. Portnet can go and help build small ports, but we have our own challenges at the moment. If private sector is willing to go out there and help
find a collective to build these boats and run them. That's the point, isn't it? We want people to work. It's not for government to employ everybody and do this. So we will be engaging them and hopefully also point them at IORC. How do you talk? But of course, if you go into IORA, you will again having to look at the interests that play there also, Australia and everybody. You know, we want to do the shipbuilding, the maintenance.
Again, just to interject, too, in the IORA, you have our Minister of International Relations, then you have the Minister of Trade and Industry, right? And you've got the Minister of Economic Development, Patel.
Mm-hmm.
You have them there.
Okay. I think I've answered all of your questions.
No.
Not?
I just wanted to know whether they actually know about this thing, these other two, in addition to this minister. Because they are both, the three of them are ministers now. They, this information about weaknesses in IORA, they should be seized with that. Now back to the main subject of Madagascar. I was asking about the strategic geopolitical importance, and I think in the main they do support our positions in the EU. They are part of the EU, then Agenda 2063, and SADC, and of course the weaknesses in the economy, and it's an advantage we can take because of their proximity. Unfortunately, because of domestic challenges, we're not there. This issue about shipbuilding and increasing trade and marine resource trade is in Agenda 2063. You find it there. I can't remember the item, whether it's 1 or 2 or 6, but revitalization of the economy, industrialization, is there in Agenda 2063. You can make your last comment.
For the strategic, as I said earlier, that because of the internal situations that they have not engaged us too much in SADC. With them, sometimes they will go more towards the Francophone as a part. So with this new president, we will have to see how that changes. But I think if we engage them, this new government, more and very quickly, I think they could become, because they also straddle, like Seychelles and Mauritius, they straddle all of these economic zones, EEC, IOI, PUMESA, they also straddle all of these groupings. Whereas Seychelles, you know that 90% of the time they vote with South Africa, they even support our position. Madagascar has not always known, because it's also part of the Francophonie, just like the other islands, but Seychelles is more clear. Mauritius also, you never know where they're going to go. But I think with the new, how quickly we engage and how decently we actually, we might find. President Harry was quite seized for a very long time. He was introverted because he was so seized politically at home that he stopped making a lot of decisions. Anything that could be controversial, he just didn't do. So our engagement, even if it's a good idea, a good project, he eventually never made the decision. So then it just fell by the way. Hopefully things will change.
Thank you, Baya.
Thank you, Baya, Mr. Kosloo.
Now I can rest. Now Kosloo can rest.
Mr. Sengiwe, I think we are now going to invite you for a presentation.
Thank you very much, Chair, for the opportunity.
I'd now like to
Thank you.
Mr. Sengwe, you are invited.
Thanks, Chair. I hope, Chair, that the point that you raised around the fact that sometimes we do not take advantage of the work that we do on the continent, that our diplomatic relations and all our initiatives do not necessarily translate into benefits for our country. I hope that we can pick up that issue as part of the discussion following the presentation on mine as well. But I think it's a broader question. And the other issue you raised, which is also a much more a broader issue, relates to the role of France, colonial masters at the time, and the tentacles that they still have in some of our endeavors in the countries that we operate in. I hope that we can follow up on those issues after this presentation as well.
No, thank you.
Chair, on Mali, we thought that we should, as requested by the committee, that we needed to share with you current developments in the country, but also as part of that, our presentation also touches on the Sahel region, because you cannot talk about Mali without talking about the region, and therefore it's important for us to have a regional perspective given some of the challenges that Mali is confronted with. Just by way of reminding the committee, if you look at the map, the location of Mali, we think that it's a very strategic location, in that Mali shares its borders with 7 other countries. Now what that means is that if you have instability in Mali, you are likely to have serious flow problems in the other countries.
Oh my God, now we check it again. I see the map.
It's not very clear.
No. I had been. Able to see it in this one.
Yes.
Yeah, moving on.
Yes.
Because we have to see it is helpful in that, you know, geographically, when you say this place, then you know this is this side, or it is at the center, or it is up there, down there. It makes you think better.
That's the reason, Chair, we thought we should just remind the committee of
the EP on a line.
Location. Mali is the one, the color, all that is Mali. And if you look...
The yellow.
All the colors. Those are various regions within Mali.
Oh, all of it.
Yes. But if you look at the north, you will see Algeria there.
Yeah.
It's one of the countries bordering Mali.
Yeah.
If you go westward,
yeah,
you will see Mauritania.
Yeah.
If you go south, you will see almost still on the east, you will see Senegal and Guinea-Conakry. And then on the south, you will see Cote d'Ivoire and Burkina Faso.
Mm.
And if you go eastward, you see Niger.
Yeah.
Those are the countries, Chair, that Mali shares its borders with. Now, the strategic importance of this is that any destabilization in Mali has a huge impact in that sub-region.
Mm.
we have seen with the scourge of terrorism. Similarly, Chair, any development initiative that are likely to yield results have a better chance given the number of countries that MINI shares borders with. Now, for us in South Africa, it is therefore in our national interest to see MINI succeed because we have economic interests in all the countries that border with MINI. So it's not just about MINI, it's about the wider region. But we'll pick up on this point later. In terms also of the population that we're talking about. I mean, Mali on its own, we are talking about 17, 18 million people. But if you look at some of the countries combined there, especially from a West African perspective, we are talking about close to 170, 180 million. That's outside Nigeria, which has the biggest life in terms of population in West Africa. Chair, you will recall that the last time we came to this committee, we spoke about the outcome of the elections in Mali and the implications thereof for us. Today, if you look at what has transpired since then, the current president who won the last round as well, Abubakar Keita, had a little bit of a difficulty immediately after elections because the coalition of the opposition parties did not warm up to him. You will also recall that during the last election, for the first time in Mali, there was a runoff, meaning there was no outright winner during the first round, and that necessitated a second round. And so the what we're reading from that is that the level of contestation is becoming more tense. And we were worried about the stance that the opposition parties had taken after the announcement of the final results. However, recently we have seen Sise, who was the one who contested with Keita during the runoff, have now made signals towards reaching out to the current president. What we're seeing now is some kind of rapprochement where initially he was not even keen to meet the president. They've just had two meetings now, and the indication is that he has accepted that Keita is the president, and he has acknowledged the fact that given Mali's problems, he should put the issue of elections aside and focus on some of the challenges that the country is currently confronting. This is an important development for the country because it bodes well for even the future elections that are going to be taking place this year, Chair. There is likely to be a referendum to create a Senate as part of the implementation of the peace agreement in Mali. They are also having municipal elections this year in October. And also, if the creation of the Senate is agreed, the likelihood is that they will have senatorial elections in November. Now, the reason I'm raising this is because if we were going to go into these elections still with the opposition that was not happy with the previous presidential elections, it would have posed a serious challenge for the country, especially given the fact that even the elections last year, the world, the continent, everybody was worried whether Mali would be able to hold elections given the current climate of insecurity in the country. It's important, Chair, if you look at the roadmap to peace and security in Mali, to reflect on the main agreement, which is the main mechanism that was agreed to going forward, and that is the Algiers Peace Agreement. And later I will talk about the role of some of the countries in Mali, their interest in the country. Algeria, France, in the main, but there's also Canada and the United States. I hope we'll talk about that. But the agreement basically was mediated by ECOWAS, and through this agreement, we saw the holding of elections. However, there are indications that some key elements of the achievement of the agreement have not been achieved, and these, in the main, relate to the disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration process in Mali. Now, you can't have a stable Mali if you have not reformed your security sector. Mali has been ravaged by all sorts of ills arising out of the collapse of Libya. And the destabilization thereof has created huge problems for the country. As a result, the government of Mali has areas that it has no authority over, especially in the north, because these are controlled by various armed groups and so on and so forth. So the importance of having this security sector reform is central in ensuring that you have a stable country. Of course, during the negotiations around the agreement, you had rebel groups that participated in that process. Some of them, due to their internal factional problems, are no longer part of the, they don't see themselves as part of the agreement. And this is one of the major challenges that Mali is facing. The parties to the agreement had given themselves up to the end of 2019 as a deadline for fulfilling some of the key commitments. The creation of a development zone, regional assemblies, establishment of a new integrated Malian army, and constitutional reform. These are some of the outstanding issues. Chair, what is the current security situation in the country? As we all know, the main source of insecurity in Mali is the absence of state authority, especially in the occupied north. The current state of lawlessness provides a conducive environment for all sorts of nefarious activities, including illicit trade in drugs, weapons, and human trafficking, and these are exploited by the terrorist groups, to finance their violent activities. Chair, you will recall that immediately after the collapse of Libya, we saw a number of people moving into the northern part of Mali. And at the same time, you had a Mali that was already in turmoil, because the Tuareg rebels, who were pushing a separatist agenda, were not recognizing the central government of Mali. So when these terrorist groups invaded the north, they found a fertile ground, in that already you had a community that was disgruntled. You had a community that was not happy with how they were treated by the central government in Bamako. Now, if you look at the map, the Bamako is right at the south, and that's where the central government operates. At the time, you had about seven or so terrorist groups operating there, including the Al-Qaeda of the Islamic Maghreb, which saw itself as a subcontractor of the Al-Qaeda. And you saw there was also the Ansar Din, there was Mujahu. Now, all these groups had some allegiance or affiliation to either ISIS or Al-Qaeda. But then they would take different forms when they operate in the country. Now, what has been the response of the international community? During the invasion in the north, we saw France moving in very, very swiftly, and immediately after that, the United Nations mission in Mali was established. And to a large degree, they've been able, these missions, to destroy some of the bases established by these terrorist groups. However, what we have seen lately is the changing face of terrorism in the region. In that, whereas initially you would have a clearly identified enemy, in that you knew that these groups are based in this particular area, and you can drop bombs, you can attack. So the military option or intervention was central in destroying their bases. But what has happened now is that phenomenon is beginning to change. What you see now is what they refer to as the endogenous face, internal face of terrorism. Because now you are no longer dealing with people who are coming from outside. You are actually dealing with your population. And what these groups have succeeded to do is to integrate themselves into the communities. And as part of that process, found themselves being part, if you like, of the social fabric of those communities. As a result, today, if you are talking about attacks, you are not sure whether these are attacks driven by inter-community conflicts or whether these are attacks inspired by terrorist groups and some of the criminal activities that creep in. It's very difficult to identify perpetrators thereof as either terrorists or just plain criminals trying to make the most of the situation in the region. I thought we should make that point because this phenomenon has now extended beyond Mali. It has now affected Burkina Faso. If you look at the map, it's more or less on the south or so. It has affected Niger as well. In fact, Chair, as I speak to you, we have a South African who was kidnapped in Burkina Faso last year, and a certain Mr. Bosma, he is still there.
Was he a mercenary?
No. Mr. Bosma was a South African working for a gold mine owned by a person of Indian origin. This gold mine is right at the border of Mali and Burkina Faso. Burkina Faso gave license to this Indian company to operate the mine. But before they did that, the communities there, almost in the Zama-Zama way of South Africa, owned the mine. So immediately you now formalize ownership. You are marginalizing those communities. And so what happened was, after they took over the mine, they were harassed by the local, you know, populace. And we speculate, and this is really a subject of speculation, that the kidnapping thereof had to do with the communities around there than terrorist groups. but we have not established the fact. But I'm raising this just to illustrate the point about not having a clearly defined enemy. And the international community, unfortunately, all our efforts in the region are driven by a military option, as if military intervention is the solution. Now, the idea that is beginning to gain currency in the region is that, yes, it is important to intervene militarily, but that military intervention is not sufficient to deal with the scourge of terrorism. Because now you're dealing with something that is really ingrained in some of these communities. In fact, here, for the first time since their independence, Burkina Faso now has areas that it has no authority over.
Same like Mali.
Mali, you know. And increasingly, we are seeing a similar pattern in the neighboring Niger. So our view as South Africa is that indeed, over and above what we're trying to do militarily through all these missions, driven by the AU, driven by the United Nations, there has to be emphasis on economic development as the ultimate solution to the scourge of terrorism. Therefore, Chair, the conflict continues to increase the number of internally displaced persons and refugees, while women and children are the worst affected. In some areas, violence results in extended suspension of school attendance and undermines the health care services. Now, what these groups do in the areas where government does not have authority, both in Burkina Faso and Mali, is that they then are the ones who provide your basic amenities that government is supposed to provide. They are the ones who will provide water, they are the ones who will provide protection, security, because government is nowhere. And so you find in areas where communities are unable to leave their communities, they end up being indebted to these groups. And so it becomes very difficult for communities to participate meaningfully in efforts aimed at eradicating these people. North of Burkina Faso, as I speak to you today, about 800 schools are not operating. The criminal justice system in the form of courts and so on, not operational. Now, who provides those services? It's these groups that have now found themselves being part of communities in those areas. Chair, initially I did indicate that you can't talk about Mali without talking about the Sahel region. Now, the Sahel region, if you look at the map that we projected earlier, it will be Mali, it will be Mauritania, Burkina Faso, Niger, and towards the east, the east and the central and Central Africa, it will be Chad. Now, these five countries decided to come together and establish a force aimed at dealing with the issues of security in their region. Now, what is good?
Please just repeat for me the Sahel region.
The Sahel region, this is the Mali is at the center, and then you have Burkina Faso, you have Niger, Mauritania, and Chad. They came together around 2014 or so, and
they are these four, right?
These five countries.
I miss one: Mali, Burkina Faso, Chad,
Niger, and Mauritania, and took a view that over and above the initiatives that are driven by the international community, they themselves, as African countries, wanted to have a collective contribution in dealing with the scourge of terrorism. And they acknowledged the fact that this is a regional problem. This is not a problem of Mali. This is a problem of that entire region. And they then adopted a two-track process, one aimed at encouraging investment, promotion in their countries, but secondly, establishing what they refer to as the G5 Sahel force. Currently, it's a force of about 5,000 units, and mainly contributed from these five countries. And they then see themselves cooperating with these other missions that are in the area. France, for example, is about 4,000 strong force under what they refer to as Operation Barkhane, whose specific focus is on Islamist insurgents. And then you have the United Nations mission, the Integrated Stabilization Mission in Mali, which is part of initiatives aimed at peace building and peacekeeping in that area. Now, these countries, their last interaction was in February this year, all the five heads of state, and they were taking stock of what was happening in their countries. What seems to be clear is that the fight against terrorism is moving very slowly. And if you take into consideration the picture that I just drew earlier, Chair, you would see that our movement forward is not as good as we're supposed to be, as it's supposed to be right now, given the fact that over the past 8 or so years, we've been trying to push back these groups in that region. Now, it's also important to note, if you talk about the role of Mali, I mean of France, that France is the strongest non-African influence in the G5. Also from a support perspective, because G5 needed resources to finance 5,000 odd soldiers. And there are efforts to try and mobilize resources for this purpose. In the presentation, Chair, we have given you an indication of the figures. I don't want to go through that in terms of what the Sahel G5 force needs and what they've been able to mobilize so far. Chair, having said that, what is our interest in the region? Our bilateral relations with Mali were established way back during the advent of our own democracy. And since then, we've had a lot of ministerial interactions between South Africa and Mali. We had only one state visit, and that was by former President Mbeki in 2001. But subsequent to that, we have had a lot of ministerial visits undertaken by our ministers. Recently, President Ramaphosa and President Keita of Mali met on the margins of the AU summit in Addis Ababa in February, and agreed to, exchange state visits. As part of the proposals that we are making for the president's program, we're also proposing that the deputy president interacts with his counterpart in Mali, just to resuscitate our interaction at the highest level. Especially because, Chair, now we are a non-permanent member of the United Nations Security Council. Mali will be featuring very prominently on the agenda of the UNSC. And so it's critical that that we start heightening our interaction with the Malians. We signed just this month, actually, or rather last month, the visa waiver agreement for diplomatic and official passport holders, something that has been outstanding for some time. And for us, Chair, this is an indication that the traffic between the two countries can start flowing. We also have agreements in a number of areas, including arts and culture, defense, and transport. We are currently considering agreements in a number of fields, including health, business operations, agriculture, and so on and so forth. Chair, what we, despite the challenges that Mali is facing from a security perspective, if you look at Bamako, the capital, and the outlying areas, they are relatively peaceful, and so we are also seeing Mali's economy beginning to pick up, and later I'm going to talk about some of the companies that are operating there and what our interests are. The areas of interest that we are encouraging South Africans to consider, South African business, are in uranium mining and processing, electricity generation, agro-processing, and so on and so forth. Chair, Mali is the third largest producing, gold producing country in the continent.
Producing?
Gold.
Wood.
Gold.
Gold.
Ah, oh, that's why they are in the front.
After South Africa and Ghana, they are the third largest producing gold producing country. And as you say, Chair, you know, sometimes it can be a curse, but this is a country that is a resource rich, and it is in our interest that we keep on interacting with them. The total trade between South Africa and Mali in 2018 was approximately $1 billion. And of course, the balance of trade being in our favor, about 970 million of that are exports from South Africa to Mali, and we're importing very little from them. But as I indicated, there are areas where in South Africa we can start making inroads, especially in the in terms of their resources. We have South African companies operating in the country, including AngloGold, Ashanti. We know that they are also operating in a number of countries in West Africa, including Ghana. We have Red Gold Resources, the MTN in the ICT sector, and a few other companies in engineering and construction. So we do have a South African business presence in the country. Apart from gold, Chair, Mali also boasts significant deposits or reserves of iron, bauxite, uranium, phosphate, and copper. Now, uranium is a very strategic resource. Chair, it is argued, and I don't have a mandate of saying this because it's not information I have verified. But when you look at the French interest in the region, remember the French are spending a lot of resources. Security, you know, trying to make sure that the stability in some of the areas there. 80% of France's energy supply is nuclear power. And uranium is key. In Niger, the neighboring country, about 30% of their uranium, the French, they get from Niger. Their uranium deposits in Mali. So, for them, the collapse of Mali has a direct bearing on what happens in their own country. And so, if you're talking interest, this is a very clear economic interest on their side. Historically, as you know, they colonized the country. As we speak, we have a huge Malian diaspora in France, more than 5,000, and there's that interaction. In fact, in Mali, I think the largest community outside the Malian people is constituted of French, so they are still there. You know, the way the French operate is that they cling to these colonies, former colonies, and unfortunately, the colonized also do not want to let go for a variety of reasons. Some see themselves as still being part of this French enterprise. The elite have their kids attending school in France. They have property in France, and so on and so forth. So there is that a relationship. The good thing, though, about the investment climate in Mali is that they have made it easy for some of these companies to operate in the country. You can repatriate your profits, all of them. Unlike in Nigeria, you will recall the tension that we had with MTN is around repatriation of dividends and profits. In Mali, you can repatriate your profits. You have the same privileges as the domestic player if you are an international player in the country. Your capital in terms of ownership can be 100%. Okay. Unlike here at home, where now we say you must partner with us. But in Mali, there's an advantage in that you can still have full ownership of your capital. They also have oil and gas, by the way, Chair.
No.
Of course, agriculture plays a very big role. Almost 39% of their GDP is the result of the sector, the agriculture. They also have a huge livestock enterprise. They contribute about 30% of the total livestock in West Africa. So if you're talking cattle and stuff like that, Mali is your country. So there are huge opportunities in the country despite some of the challenges. Now, Chair, perhaps just to, before we talk about some of the engagements and our position on Mali currently, perhaps just to say who are the other players in the area. We have the United States of America, which has been there for a very long time. Of course, using USAID as a catalyst to secure contracts and so on in Mali. And as I indicated, you have France, France is Mali's third largest donor behind US and Canada. Canada is also playing a critical role. In fact, if you look at France's 16 priority countries, they have what they refer to as priority countries, which is part of the French development policy. Mali is one of them, and of course the number of countries that they colonized are part of that. Algeria has played a very meaningful role in mediation between the government of Mali and the Tuareg rebels initially. They also played a very important role in facilitating the current Algiers agreement. In fact, it was the agreement was signed in Algeria. It is in their interest also to have a stable Mali, because the region between Mali and Algeria is almost devastated. And this is where you find some of these terrorist groups finding cover, because it's a vast area. And if something happens in Algeria, then the French become worried, because France is their neighbor. And then, Chair, perhaps the last set of issues that we wanted to raise relate to our position in the region. We obviously support the peace agreement, and as part of AU, we want to see this agreement being implemented, which will then see a peaceful and a stable country. We also respect Mali's territorial integrity, and we support fully all these initiatives that we referred to, the G5 Sahel Joint Force, the work of the United Nations mission in Mali. We also support the ongoing efforts by the regional economic community there, ECOWAS, in promoting peace and security in that region. But more importantly, Chair, just to reiterate the fact that as a non-permanent member of the UNSC, we will play a pivotal role as a country in the deliberation of the agenda item on Mali, and hopefully intercede on behalf of the people of that country. Chair, perhaps let me end there. I have skipped some of the slides, but there is a lot of information there. But I thought I should highlight what is key in terms of our relationship with this country. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Tsengiwe, for your worthy contribution and input. How do I begin my comment? That the comment is that it is extremely and exceedingly unfortunate that many members of my committee have the commitments that they have, which I understand. For instance, the two are attending the interview of the Magistrates Commission. I also used to be deployed, but when I was still in the province, to the Judicial Services Commission.
to interview the judges. And the others are attending the capacity building program on conflict resolution for women. I don't know whether it's this region or the whole continent. Now, I'm saying it is unfortunate in that not only the members of this committee, but in Parliament, how I wish members of Parliament could have been able to get to grips with this kind of information. Getting to grips with this kind of information because in various ways they interact with the leadership of the African continent as public representatives, councillors, MPs, ministers, presidents. To know and see how their own continent looks like and then bring in this capacity building program on conflict resolution and educate them that wherever they may find themselves, they then know what is happening in the African continent, then what intervention can they bring in can they bring in on conflict resolution. This is one of the conflict areas that are enabling developments in the continent. It's unfortunate in that context that my colleagues are not here for very good and understandable reasons. Two, I have always wondered, and I didn't succeed, but each time the department made a good presentation, I would say that I wish you could address party caucuses, particularly the big ones, and combine the small ones. The DA has got 89, the ANC has got 249. Then, out of these 13 parties, the others can be combined. Just to know how the world looks like and how the African continent looks like. I'm not sure if the next committee or through whatever means it could attend to something like this. I see that Minister of Health is successful in from time to time coming in to address caucus on the national health insurance system, where we are, what are the improvements, etc., etc. They will have maybe who minister, and then I come to remain. We don't know who will be the minister and the deputy minister in the after the election. But it's something that Alan I better from time to time, just to package information about the continent. Because I'm sorry for this. What NGO? NGO to now. And this city, foreign policy, it focuses on Africa. And this is your Africa. This is what you have in the DRC, this is what you have in Mali. Now, I was going to ask you about the characterization of the Sahel region, but already in one of the pages, I think you have already characterized it. I was going to ask you to characterize it in another context. That is it, am I correct to think that the northern part of Mali, in the same way as the northern part of Nigeria, and many of the northern parts of these countries, you know, Chad, are in large numbers, without attempting to put it in large numbers, in terms of religion, they are Muslim. And they are Muslim, and they are poor, and to that extent, they are the first areas in terms of that religion to be entry points for terrorist formations like your Al Qaeda, your ISIS, in whatever mutative or guise. You know, they always mutate from one name to another and appear in various guises, as you have correctly said, that they have in some parts of these countries, including Mali, become endogenous, and therefore they are very difficult to identify, because in fact when you clamp down on them, you actually clamp down on your community. But when you say no, you can't attack the civilians, actually the terrorist is embedded among these people. So that characterization, this characterization that I'm asking about, is going to make anyone who's a Christian like me unfair to the Islam religion, because you could easily be mistaken to be Islamophobic, the word like that. You see, it will be like you are blaming them for this. But, and if you take it to the extreme, then it takes you back to the war of the Crusaders in many centuries ago, where you had the battle for religious superiority between Christianity and the Islamic religion. Now then, pursued at the level of the government by, you know, the emperor, you see. So, and if that is the case, it means these kind of countries, these regions, will not get a political sleep, because the whole agenda is that the country must be a caliphate, you see. And you must impose a Muslim religion, Muslim culture, Muslim polity, Muslim everything in that country. Part of the problem in Sudan is this one. Now, the second thing was which you almost answered when you talking about the endogenization of these armed groups. Because in other characterizations, they call them other armed groups. Now, other armed groups, somewhere they are known as the Tuareg, somewhere they are known as the White Army, the Janjaweed, that and that. But everywhere else, the other armed groups have got an interest in the instability of the community, because they are trading within the areas that government is not controlling. Now, what is unfortunate, therefore, is that there are areas where government is unable to impose security through the army, through the police, through intelligence. Did we try to find out again, or likely to accuse another country, who is financing these other armed groups, your Tuaregs and others? And if where government has no control, they are trading in ivory, gold, bauxite, in copper, in uranium, etc., where does it go to? Because you see, if it goes to China, it goes to France, it goes to Russia, it goes to the USA, etc., etc., then the problem would not go away, because these Zama-Zamas, these local Zama-Zamas, are a necessary conduit, are a necessary evil for the recipient countries, because they must create this instability and get this thing then it must go to the country that needs them. See, the reason why Savimbi could stay for almost 30 years and was in the Cabinda region, if I remember well, you see, where Angola had difficulty in imposing control. But the thing that he was getting there was actually he was using the local mineral resources to purchase military hardware, uniforms, yeah, and everything else. So the government, and therefore Angola couldn't develop. We don't have the time, but when I asked one of my comrades who was in Angola, Opomonama, about the situation, said, no, between Savimbi and NATO, one of them must die before they can be peace. And that was 1992. Fast forward, after Savimbi's death, then peace returned to that country. How apt was that analysis of that comrade in 1992? So these are the kind of situations sometimes that face this country. But I was saying, are we able to know who is financing these other armed groups? Where are their trade going to? And then whisper them to the leadership of the African continent, and then through the African Union Security Council take a decision to create an offensive force to clamp down. Because what I realized about the peacekeeping mission, some of them African, some of them United Nations, they have been variously accused by other political scientists of getting into a situation and not going out. In other words, it's a peacekeeping mission forever. Why? Because the soldiers that are drafted and they're paid under the United Nations are making a lot of money in terms of insurance, salaries and all those things. So if at home they're getting 4,000 and there they're getting 12,000, they would like to stay there for as much as is possible, and when they come out, of course there's a risk, but when they come out with a lot of money. So if you look at the state of the duration of their stay, they actually don't want to go out. So the leadership needs to look at the peacekeeping missions, why they stay long and all those things. But if you look at what happened with the M23 in the DRC, which became an offensive force on M23. It was only then that the M23 was actually weakened, because they were hitting on them. It was like, you don't fight this one, it's just peacekeeping. They were actually hitting the other side. So this is what you may need here, and I'm not sure if in our discussions we then were able to whisper this. And these are things that, for instance, we the South Africans cannot write down, but you can whisper to the leadership, like Mr. Forslund yourself, you were saying, just between these walls. What you already know, and I know, is that there are many countries in the world that want South Africa to be Africa's policeman, if you like. A role that we always say, no, we don't want to do that. Countries must be on their own, etc., etc., etc. But we keep saying, you know, each region, there must be, for lack of a better word, Mr. Foslo Bass. not the one, the old one. But you must have a kind of a regional Bass in Latin America and in the world. There must be somebody that you fear not to do certain things because there are consequences. And they think that South Africa working with, say, a country like Nigeria could play that role. And that role, if it continues to be absent, then this is the situation. So that alone means the political colonization of Africa may have gone, but the economic colonization continues, because people get what they used to get that time. Now, when I'm making comments and questions, whether, for instance, the question is whether, would you then say that the state of Mali, would we say that that state almost has collapsed? Because it's security forces cannot safeguard certain regions. It's courts cannot try people who misbehave. The police, the intelligence, and others. That is very much close to a collapsed state, or a semi-collapse of that state. It's a very worrisome situation. There were just two others. Yeah. The security situation on page 6. I see a massive state of looting there. The current state of lawlessness in North provides a conducive environment for various illicit trade. Now, that takes you back to the report by President Thabo Mbeki about the loss of a lot of money through tax and tax avoidance in the continent by international corporations who are not paying tax through this kind of thing. There must be this environment or this situation then for them to operate in this way. And what happens? Illicit trade, illicit financial flows become very huge, and the state can't sustain itself because the state does not work anyway. It works from taxing companies and taxing civil servants and other things. That's where they raise their tax revenue. The more these things shrink, the companies, the workers shrink, the state revenue shrinks. And this looting that is happening there. And this is not a matter for small ones like me in parliament and officials like you in DECO. It's a matter for presidents, for the leaders of the African continent to deal with. In other fora where we sit, I sit in the SADC parliamentary forum, I think we've tried to raise some of these things and actually find a very diplomatic way of blaming ourselves that besides the ills of the colonial powers, but now that we are in charge, we must also play our role, because for instance in South Africa you cannot keep on saying apartheid, but one day it will be 70 and 90 years ago. Okay, blame it on apartheid, but you must do something. So the same as in Nigeria, they must blame colonialism, but they must do something. I think the book written by Obasanjo, Greg Mills, and the other one, I actually saying that the situation in Africa can be turned around, but the leadership must know where it is getting to. Because otherwise, if you think blaming the past is the right thing, then you get stuck. So then the issue of the people who are becoming increasingly stateless, or by forced migration, or internally displaced persons, largely move towards South Africa because of stability and other Now, when you were saying that about 5,000 or so of the Malian diaspora is in France, then it answered a particular question. Because it, this phenomenon of the elite groups who are in the security forces and in the political structures actually get a blessing to run government. Then they don't stay in their country, they are rich, they stay in France. But if they become a spent force or they get out of, then they get out, then they get exiled in the same country, then they bring another one. But this one will stay peacefully there, he will have money with his wife and children. Then you see that kind of thing. So, and this thing, and I don't want to bring France alone, brings in tension among the Africans. When you're talking about African unity, you don't find it because there is always the traditional and law phone tensions of old. Now find expression in the African continent. It is said that in France, if you are asking for a direction, say it in any other language, you'll get it. But if you say it in English and you are black, you bring English here, you're not going to get it. You see, say it in any other language, then they will try to assist you. Because English and France have had contestation for diplomatic superiority there for years. And the French found their way. There are a lot of concepts in the diplomatic world that are in French. So that tension among the Africans is there in the African continent. So it will largely weaken and kill the local. So I was just saying the internally displaced peasants of Mali, the elite are in France. The others are placed among the neighboring countries. Then this influenza then in Mali gets into Burkina Faso, etc., etc., etc. There was also something that I thought I asked about the religion. Now you were talking about the French company. What was that? Page 13, trade relations. Perhaps this one would not come as a question, it would come as a contribution by me in other platforms where we say that part of the problem of the growth of the intra-African trade, intra-African, is lack of infrastructure of various types, the railroad, the quality of the roads, the airports, the airports from one region to another instead of going to France and come back or going to England and come back, the tunnels, the dams, telecommunication, and other things that you can't increase intra-African trade to the level of the African, the European Union, which is around 60%, and they are nearer each other. If you're talking about this year, there are physical constraints. The harbors are the old colonial harbors and small. So, and the airports, so they need to be increased. So, you see, so therefore the signing of the African Continental Free Trade Area, which makes it a massive trade community, is good, but the trade among the Africans themselves becomes small. And this is what then you also see in Mali. And this problem is actually an opportunity for the companies of South Africa. The issue we're talking about earlier on, that you know, our diplomats must see opportunities, like you were also saying, see opportunities, then address South African companies to go and develop this infrastructure, go and develop this and that. As the only diversified economy in the continent, because Nigeria might be big, but it's only oil. Everything else is backward.
Okay, you can make your general comments.
Now, I should have also I asked a question or made a comment about the polity of the country, like I did with DRC, Lesotho, and Madagascar, that would it be your view that it has a history of instability of sorts, whatever the reasons, and that alone, for instance, like not accepting the results, the rebel groups, etc., that alone is good aside for instability so that people can do other things. Yeah. Thank you very much.
No, thanks, Chair. Perhaps just to start with the last comment, Chair, about the politics of Mali. Chair, you will recall that for the longest time, and also informed.
All the horses can run.
Let's have a 1 minute break. Let me just go to the loo.
was not, of course, Gaddafi was able to appease all the different groups in Libya. Libya actually is made up of different traditional groups and so on and so forth. But Gaddafi was able to put a lid on the differences between the groups in Libya. So when Libya collapsed, the Malians, some of them had to go back to Mali because Libya was no longer a conducive place to stay in.
Yeah.
At the same time, within the terrorist groups saw an opportunity.
Mm.
And Libya had a proliferation of arms. Gaddafi was amassing a lot in terms of equipping his military. So those arms found their way in Mali. So when they went to Mali, these groups, they were well armed. They had all the resources.
Mm.
So that is the connection with the collapse of Libya. Now, you spoke about displaced people. Now, what is happening is that you are again seeing people now going back, but not to Libya, but through Libya to Europe. You know, the people who die in certain excursions trying to reach Italy and so on and so forth, they go through Libya is the hub.
Oh.
Yeah, they go through Libya. But those that then went back to Mali, because in Mali you also had the Tuaregs. These are the groups that were anti-establishment. Even during the time that Mali was stable. And so the terrorist groups that came in found space and interacted. In fact, there are people who argue that the group hijacked the cause of the Tuaregs and they radicalized them. Of course, now using the ideology of ISIS, of Al Qaeda, and indeed finding a space, because you are talking about more or less in terms of religion the same group of people, so they were able to find each other. But these ones were more radicalized. The Tuaregs were just fighting a struggle like in any other country. I mean, you know, in Cameroon today, the South, the Anglo phone Cameroon, they are fighting for their own space. You go to Senegal, the Casamance are fighting, the small groups fighting for their own space. But they are not terrorist groups. But what happened in Mali, with all the arms coming from Libya and the traffic there, they radicalized the Tuareg, a rebellion basically. And now you are in Mali, you no longer even talk a lot about the Tuareg. The emphasis is on the armed groups, you know, Al Qaeda of the Islamic Maghreb and so on and so forth. So the politics in Mali currently, I don't think it's in the areas where the government is working. I don't see a group coming up trying to stage a coup at this point. And that is why we're making a point earlier about the fact that the leader of the coalition of the opposition parties only recently tried to reach out to the current president, signifying the fact that they probably are not interested in taking over through other means. And so that's the one set of issues. The other set of issues, Che, is you are correct. The ingredients of a failed state, you find there. Well, the failed state basically, I mean, the central responsibility of a state is to protect its territory.
Mm.
That's the central responsibility. But in instances where a state cannot, then you can easily say it's a failed state. But here you are dealing with a huge area, almost desert-like. You're not talking about a country like ours, where, you know, the Western Cape can secede from South Africa, and because of the geographic location, you know, the Western Cape can do its own thing. It's also complicated by the confluence of a number of things. There's religion, there's ethnicity, there's geographical location. Chair, you spoke about the northern part and the southern part in these countries. The interesting thing is that in our country, when we think northern part of our country, northern suburbs, these are affluent areas. It's the opposite in some of these countries. If you go to Nigeria, the north is the poorest. The south is the richest because oil is in the south. If you go to Mali, the south is the richest, the north is the poorest. But the other demographic factor that we need to be conscious of is that in terms of religion, we are talking about the majority Muslim people.
Throughout the country,
generally Muslim people. The difference is in the some regard themselves as moderate Muslims, but fundamentally they are Muslims. Others are the radicalized ones. In Burkina Faso, for example, the majority there, almost 80% of the population, is Muslim people. Mainly moderate Muslims. The rest are Christians, about 20%, mainly the Catholic faith. but there are no tensions between Christians and Muslims there. You find that tension in Nigeria. So it varies depending on the history of the country and how they've been socialized. In Mali, as I say, the majority are Muslim. It's just that some of them have now been highly radicalized. So in terms of the potential for instability at a political level, we don't anticipate that you would have a situation like that, because the main political groups operating in that space, I think, have a common enemy, and that is their rally point. And I think they also are aware of the fact that if they start bickering among themselves, they won't be able to defeat what is a common denominator in terms of the stability of the country. So yes, there are two wells in one. One, no authority of the state. The rest, yes, there is authority of the state, and that's the Mali that we are encouraging even South African businesses to start interacting with, because there is a lot that can be amassed there for in our own national interest as a country. Now the second point here is that I thought I should just allude to relates to issues of infrastructure. And earlier on you had spoken about the fact that sometimes we don't capitalize on leverage on the goodwill that we have with some of these countries based on our intervention in some instances, whether it's mediation, whether it's humanitarian support, whether it's economic cooperation. Now we have, and I want to juxtapose this with this notion that the French are still the dominant player. And of course now there are other non-traditional players, the Chinese are coming in. But what we are seeing on the ground is slightly nuanced. We have examples of countries, Ivory Coast, Mali, Ghana, Senegal. They say to South Africa, South Africa, here is an opportunity. Here is an opportunity. But we're not taking up some of those opportunities. Ouattara in Ivory Coast is very close to the French. I mean the Sarkozy, the former president, was actually Ouattara's best man in during his wedding. That's how close they are. But they themselves are saying, but we also want to engage you in South Africa. They are seeing a partner in us, and in some instances, really, we are not taking advantage of those opportunities. Senegal, which is also French-speaking, they started about 5 or so years ago using South Africa as a destination of choice when it comes to medical services. They appreciated the quality of medical services that we provide in this country. And in fact, they started now not going to France for the elite and everybody who can afford. They were not going to France for their medical needs. They were coming to South Africa. South Africa, here is an opportunity. Why don't we partner with them, establish facilities there, so that these people don't necessarily have to come here. You deal with them on the ground. We are not taking up some of these opportunities. Ghana, as recently as October, November last year, were auctioning oil blocks in Ghana. And they were saying to South Africa, we are auctioning these blocks, but we don't want you to participate in the bid process. We want you to choose.
Look at that.
We want you to choose blocks, and then the remainder we will auction for the other countries. So that's how close the relationship is. And sometimes, you know, we don't vocalize this a lot. Petro SA, Department of Energy, we have an opportunity. We don't take up these opportunities, we miss out. So there is that fact also on the ground. Juxtapose, if you look at, you know, French influence, the Chinese now are coming in, we have serious competition on the continent. Yes, they are there. And I don't think ours is to concentrate on what they are doing. Ours is to focus on the niches that we are, you know, being exposed to in almost all these countries. I mean, we share with them, or they share with us, their national development plan. Ouattara says by 2030, I want Ivory Coast to be a developed country. This is the path towards that. These are the infrastructure development projects that we are going to be facilitating going forward. Mm-hmm. Yes, we take up some of them, but the idea that if we go and bid for these projects, they will go to a French company because the French historically have, you know, been a friend to the country and so on and so forth. Sometimes it doesn't. That argument doesn't hold water. There are opportunities. Mali is key. They have now said to our president, please, another state visit, so that we can, at the highest level, you know, demonstrate that the two countries can. And within that, there are a lot of opportunities. Well, some of the projects that I referred to and the minerals and the opportunities in Mali that I spoke to during the presentation, they are there for South African business, and in particular our state-owned companies to take advantage of. Chair, lastly, the issue of who funds these rebel groups and these armed groups and so on. The sense we are getting is that on the one hand, you have governments that are weak. Weak in the sense that a government is unable to generate its own revenue, and they rely on another government for budget support.
Yeah.
Just to run their own internal or domestic program. So they rely on somebody else to do that.
Mm.
Now, these weak states and a number of them have these characteristics in that region.
Mm.
I mean, if you look at, for example, Burkina Faso, I happened to have served there for 4 years during Compaoré's time. You know, Compaoré had ruled that country for 27 years or so, but then due to popular uprising, he was chased away by the population in 2014 or so. But before that, Compaoré, although he was being elected into government in a free and democratic election, he was also complicit in the looting of the resources of the state. Now, this is a person who's at the helm, who's supposed to be protecting these resources. So on the one hand, you find an elite in this country, political elite, being complicit in the looting itself. These are the people who are supposed to be protecting the past. In Burkina Faso, for example, their gold mines formalized, but almost 50-60% of the yield there does not go through the formal process. Meaning, it's taken directly from the mine straight to China. Only a percentage of that goes through the formal process, where you can then say, we need to tax, we need to make sure that some of the revenues go towards government. But who is facilitating that? It's the state. The state itself is complicit. Then the other set of issues is where you have now these armed groups self-funding. So they then colonize a mine or an area, and whatever.
They
started the Zama Zama, and they end up taking over completely.
Yeah.
And they use those. Where the problem is, I mean, we know the Sierra Leone story of the diamonds there, and so on. You need to suffocate those activities by not engaging in commercial activities with those kind of people,
like President Charles Taylor did.
Yes, but what do? We are the ones who buy from them. So you find the elite there. Some of them benefit because they are part of the network there. You know, the supply chains and so on. So they benefit from these illicit flows to the extent that some of them are then accused of even protecting some of these rebel groups. And when in that region, Chair, all the countries now, I mean, Burkina Faso, Niger, Ivory Coast, have been affected by what is happening in Mali, because there's been a spillover into their countries. But for the longest time, Burkina Faso never had a problem. During Compaoré's time, he himself had direct contact with the
Taliban.
Yes. And almost had an understanding that you are not going to destabilize my country. Right? But what is it that I'm going to do? I can provide you with some space if you are under pressure, under the radar, provided you don't attack my country. Now it becomes a nationalistic, narrow understanding of how terrorists operate. Well, now you're saying my country is not going to be affected. Every other country can be affected. As a result, when Compaoré, as a regime collapsed, you started seeing now Burkina Faso being attacked as well. And the intelligence services, which were centralized around President Compaoré, started disintegrating. I'm raising this here just to point out to the complexity of the relationships and the confluence of factors. Well, it's not only about the rebel groups trying to do something. even the leadership in some of these countries are sometimes found to be complicit in these activities for one or the other reason.
Very, very useful. You are speaking to the right person, except that now
I can speak without it. Because I'm just concluding.
I was saying,
we are speaking to the right person, but look, you must not be selfish and think me only. Because you know what has happened. Raniti himself in the SADC parliamentary forum, and some other time, I bought a book called Architects of Poverty by Mwele Jimbe. The book is very scathing in its attack to the leadership of the African continent. Then, of course, there was the other one, general about the African people, Capitalist Nigger. And I read this one by Greg Mills. Greg Mills and Obasanjo. I think now they've gone in. They've produced another version, but now they are four. But I think the other three ones are still remain, making Africa work, something like that. They've also written another version, making South Africa work. And now, I have always been not liking what they were saying for quite some time, until I was a chairperson of this committee. And now from time to time we hear something about the DRC. Then I began to appreciate the extent of omissions of the African leader, that it is not enough in South Africa to blame apartheid alone. Not that you must not blame it, because some of the vestiges of apartheid are still here, physical one, right? And then Nigeria. Now Obasanjo says the same thing. He says, I was the president of Nigeria, and we Nigerians have been independent for 6 years, but there are things that we cannot show, and we are in charge. Then they point out that the Zambia, the issues of the roads and these reports and other things. Now you couldn't mistaken them. If these things that they are saying are said by a French or an English in UK or an American, they must be racist. But if they are said by the Africans who have been leaders and they are proudly African, they say, we could do this, or we should do this, we should have done this. We're blaming ourselves for some of the weaknesses. Then I began to like those books, because I have always thought that Patimwele baby, his brother was the president, why is he sounding like he's bitter, the beneficiary of the BEE? His observations were correct. Now you have just said that here is a president of a country who is party to the rebels, and the rebels are mining this site. He says, no, ngzobashaya, batakabashaya, oryabashaya, batakabashaya. You no longer know what I'm talking about. I'm saying, he says, I've clamped down on them, or appears to be clamping down, but is not finishing them, because the president of the country is. You see, that's real estate capture by the rebels. Because the president is committing, what do you call that in constitution? Outsourcing the authority of the state when you've taken an oath to this thing that Mandela were arrested for.
Treason.
If a president does that, he's actually committing treason. And I found that Charles Taylor was doing the same thing, actually, supporting the rebels who were mining certain areas,
both in Sierra Leone and in Chad, and working with them, and then using the authority of the state. Then they bring these things here, then they go out of to the other countries, and then as a president he was benefiting. And then they were calling that economic something. Among the charges that were put to him was funding those rebel groups, destabilizing a neighboring country, something like commercial crimes or something like that, when he was being tried by the ICC, etc., etc. Now, so I'm saying these are things that we must talk about in some of the platforms of the ruling party and others. And some appreciate when we say these things. Some, I talked about this in Zimbabwe, was actually the Speaker of Zimbabwe came guns blazing on me for blaming the African leadership on certain things, etc., etc. Now, 6 months later, President Mugabe was toppled, and the speaker said, I must ask them to brief me about the developments and to come and brief her. Now, we went to their hotel, which was separate from mine, to go and discuss that. They said, hey, but, we shall you more, Yala, President. For you, Mr. Paul, what could it be in English? Shall you more? It's like the absence of Mugabe.
Fresh
air, and something like that. That's suffocation. But I said, but I didn't mention President Mugabe, but I just talk about characteristics of our own omissions and undoings in the continent. And you came out on me. But you know what? You'll never know who Mugabe has everywhere you go. And remember, I'm a head of parliament there. So we needed to say these things should not happen. Because I knew, among other things, you were referring to Zimbabwe about the denial of human rights that then people move to one country. So that's the problem, yeah, Tawo. Yeah, well, I'm just saying these things are worth raising. But of course, people will look at camps at you from the African continent. Sometimes within the country, you seem to be blaming the African leaders. Sister Neo, you want to assist?
Well, Tristan, I was just saying, since in listening, having listened to even other previous presentations from different branches of the department, it seems like maybe for the sixth Parliament, the issue which needs to be flagged. It seems like the department is having a bit of a frustration in terms of their work. They go out, explore opportunities and areas of cooperation, but the departments which are supposed to respond are not doing so. We had that from Africa now, and even during the overnight visit, this issue was raised. We had it also from Southeast Asia, where the branch was saying, actually that cooking also has also laid a complaint to say, we seem to be concentrating on China alone and not the others. It also came from the Gulf region that we are not specifically, you know, outright coming and responding. So it's a matter of, maybe the committee will need to explore whether is it lack of harmony in terms of policies between trade and the department, or is it lack of, there is something going on there. Because now I can see the department getting frustrated because of, you know, this work becomes, you know, it's not finished. It's left hanging, whereas they would have actually established and explored opportunities which would could assist the country to move forward. So I think it's an area which the Peace Committee also will need to follow up on. I think I should just make that observation.
Yeah, the observation is very spot on. Can't we in a 2-3 line in the legacy report talk about increasing confirmation between this department and trade and industry, between this portfolio committee and the portfolio committee of trade and industry and of economic development, when it comes to discussing programs of economic development, trade development, and economic opportunities for South African businesses, which would have been created by DERCO having diplomatic relations, which lead to bilateral relations. Then South African companies then must come in. You must serve national interest out of that. Then we say there's a weakness, but there's a weakness also here in Parliament. As I was saying, from me as chair. Of course, there are difficulties. You need to be called to these meetings of the economic by someone senior to you, like Frolic. But Frolic is the chair of all committees. You need a chair of the committees of this one. And sometimes you may be wanting to do this, then the other one happens to be in one way or another senior to you. For instance, trade and industry. I mean, we're energy. We have been shocked by NSC member and when a fellow business from the other side, from Kambi Sontu and Naki, Sontu and Naki, so those kind of things. I think it's something that we can factor in, which is good. Among the number of things that were in the way forward, issues for consideration by the Swiss Parliament, we could say our confirmation must be increased among the three committees in particular. Then the second one, and of course among the ministry, the CEO, and then again, and a security cluster for stabilization of the African continent, since it is the central pillar of or the focal pillar of the Africa of our foreign policy, is making Africa. very useful information that has been shared with us. And as I always say, and I'm not going to tire from saying that, the members of parliament from time to time engage other colleagues, debate, raise statements, motions without notice, interview. The quality of their input depend on the extent to which they know about the subject. So a department has always been coming as a very useful resource when it comes to pumping in information like this. And for that, we must say that we are grateful. I'm not sure if there will be other officials presenting between now and the 20th. But for me personally, I have benefited quite a lot thanks to the privilege of being the chair. And being exposed to the parliamentary forum and the information here, etc., etc. One has been able to at least participate meaningfully in other engagement, which included, for instance, my postgraduate studies in the UK. At least there were things that already I know about Africa when we're doing transitional justice existence of the other armed groups, the Jaja Wing and these mutations and the rebels, etc. They actually come across these things, then you find that you are exposed to some other information which makes you interpret perhaps the assignment better, you see. Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
The in terms of the agenda, what was the next item?
Adoption
in terms of the agenda is the adoption of the committee minutes.
Yes,
you remember we have said that this one and the legacy report are deferred to
next week. Yes, sir.
Yeah, but the way we're looking at it yesterday in the management committee, we're saying it might be a bit compulsory that we must go through that next week. Announcements? Announcements are that next week we'll look at the legacy report, we'll look at the minutes, I think the study group will look at the legacy report. I must have developed the political legacy report. Faith is looking at the format, whether if I'm here or not. So we've got to make sure we tightened up here the other week.
And
the
oversight.
Those things, mainly in the management and then in the study group.
The Ibambo Mtene, the study group will start next week. From management to the study group, sends a show which is the Titan Shaga app. The new minister will find the time and space, so what is between now and between. Because she wants to come and talk about the UN Security Council, the DRC, and others, but find a way of closing off this app for this year. So we're also discussing that in PLO. With that, colleagues, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much. Yeah, but among other things, the meeting is adjourned.
Yeah.
The one is in chains. That's cool.